I have been a pastor for 47 years, actually. I surrendered to answer God's call in my life when I was 16, and I pastored my first church when I was 19. And that was a trusting congregation. let me tell you, that was back in Oklahoma, and I was still going to college, and I had decided, because of my agricultural background, to take the scholarship at Oklahoma State University and study agriculture. But in less than a semester, I was going back and forth preaching in little country churches, and I realized that's what God wanted me to do, not judging crops. And so when I returned to my hometown, immediately continued to do that, but I needed to find a university where I could benefit from the knowledge and experience, but what was going to help me as a pastor. I didn't want to go to a Christian university, I'm sorry, because I wanted to know that my faith was going to work wherever I went. So I chose a state university, and I chose radio and TV broadcasting. Because I thought that was going to help me more in the areas that I think I gave you that advice too, Tim. I'll introduce some of these guys in a moment, but Tim Jennings, when I moved here and took the church that was Byron, Pastor Byron, raise your hand. Byron was the sending church of the church that I took in Mesa. Mike and Sheila were members, prayer members of that church. And it was at that church that we had a transition in office staff, and Tim was going into your senior year? Going into his senior year, and he was working for Foot Locker at the mall, Superstition Springs. And they were pulling him more and more away from church. His dad had just retired from the Marine Corps in California. They'd moved here. He's working for an air conditioning company. They put the air conditioner on our building, and so they came to church. And so that's how that began. But I was looking at Tim, and I realized we're about to lose this guy. Because Foot Locker's going to ask him to start working on Sundays. So I approached the youth minister. I don't know if you know, I talked to your parents too. and I said, what if we hire Tim to be our office manager at the church? And that way when he comes from school, he can come to church and we won't lose him. And now he's pastoring Superstition Foothills in Gold Canyon. And and this is his wife and beautiful kids. And they're going to share a little bit later on. My ministry has been kind of all over the place. And coming to Arizona was a definite call. I didn't understand why at first. And I just knew this is where he wanted me. And in a very short period of time, as Mike has alluded to, two things happened. One was that I have to look around, make sure they're not here. Because some of them were going to come today, but a group of gypsies started coming to my church. I had no idea who they were. And in the course of just a few months, well, actually, they were there for months, and then they left because they travel, right? And so they're all contractors. They're all businessmen. They all drove these big trucks with equipment on it and everything. And they said, I asked them about church life and membership and the Bible, and they said, yeah, but we'll be back next year. But they were too young to be snowbirds, right? So I didn't quite understand it. And then the next year they came and said, hey, I've got a camp out in Apache Junction. My aunt owns it and all my family's out there. I want them to hear what you're sharing, but I don't think I can do it. Do you think you could come and share with us? So I went out and met them at their mobile home. Actually, it was a trailer. They pull their houses behind their trucks, right? And so it's either a fifth wheel or a pull behind trailer. And as I sat down with the gentleman, he shared with me everything. I got a crash course in culture, like in a moment. He shared with me their language is still intact. Their process of marrying is still intact. Their process of caring for the elderly is still intact. Their culture is the most important thing in the world to them. And he laid all of this out to me, what their businesses are and all that business. And then we went to the clubhouse and 86 of his family members were there. And we shared the gospel, and later that month, I baptized 11 of those people. I see them as the great evangelists of our day. The reason being is they are unemployed every day. They have to go knock on somebody's door every day, to get a job. And I've been with them many places, all up and down the San Joaquin Valley in Apple Valley, California, in New Mexico, in Port Huron, Michigan. I've been with them everywhere. And when they knock on a door and somebody comes and is distressed or troubled, they stop their sales pitch, they share the gospel, and they pray with them. And if more gypsies were like this, then it's going to be an incredible opportunity around the world. But let me tell you that people ask me all the time, they criticize gypsies, right? They say, they do really poor work, don't they? And I say, when's the last time you hired a contractor? There are good contractors, and there are bad contractors, right? That's just kind of the way it is. Most of my guys own the contracts on all the McDonald's restaurants in, like, New Mexico. They do all the highway mountain passes in most of our states. Passing, paving, you know, compression tests and all this. Great people. You're going to love them. So God put them in my life, and that became a whole. I actually can speak their language. Their language is 1,000 years old. It came from Punjab, India. And they still speak it today. They mix it with English, so sometimes you won't know what they're saying. And then the other part of coming to Arizona and Byron, and Mike and Sheila probably didn't know that, was to give away the land that the church was on that I was on. And that went to the Word Church, where I met Troy. And the Word Church was predominantly African-American church that was meeting in a real estate building. And I asked the pastor one day, I said, if somebody offered to give you land, what would you do? And he said, we'd take it. And so we've had a fantastic relationship with that congregation. I'm sad that I gave them the land. And the reason I'm sad is because it wasn't more. Because if it had been more, I think their church would have even greater impact than it has at this time. Go right up Stapley Drive, just north of Southern, and on the east side of the street, you'll see the Word Church. It's a beautiful place. Great, great worship stuff going on there. So I work for the North American Mission Board, one of your missionaries. If you contribute to offerings here through the cooperative program, money cycles that way. I don't know how I got that position, honestly. I'm not qualified. I want you to know I'm not qualified at any of these positions. I don't have a college degree. I don't have a seminary degree. I don't qualify as a missionary. I don't qualify in any of these positions. God's just, you know, he's maneuvered my life to be in the place that it's in. So it's really whatever it is, it's his. Whatever it is, it's his. So in that process of working for the North American Mission Board, working with gypsies, I started working with Malta Housing because gypsies live in Malta Housing. And my director of missions at the time said, do you think that we might be able to concentrate on Malta Housing? I don't know if you've looked at all the apartments going up around you. You know, we're 250,000 apartments behind in order to accommodate the people that are in the valley. And if you look at apartment communities, there's a couple of things, national statistics, local statistics, a couple of things is that less than 5%, Tim, you can tell, you can affirm this, you lived in one of them. Lou, you lived in one of them. See, my guys actually go and live in these places so that they can reach the people there. Less than 5% of the people ever come out of those communities and go to anybody's church. Anybody's church. And so we believe it's our job to go to them, to take the church to them, to establish a relationship, to build a relationship with the managers, and Lou's going to talk about that in just a moment and his experience in that. So I've always looked at church differently, since Arizona especially. There's no knock on any of the forms of church. I think today, Troy, you attended Sun Valley, right? And that's a big church. My daughter and her husband serve in a church in Forney, Texas, that has 5 campuses and a 6th online campus, and they run about 6,000. And but I tell you what, bigness is not necessarily greatness, okay? Nor is smallness community. It kind of works both ways. We can lose track of what it is that church is. At the core, church is ecclesia. Church is the called out ones. called out from among the people and called to follow Jesus. Let me give an example of how we get confused and then we'll go. Was that enough, Mike? Okay. So he wanted me to give an intro. I don't like to talk about that stuff. But there was a pastor who felt like that they needed a van to do some things with senior adults, to do some things with young people, to take their staff on retreats and meetings. And so he got a dealer to loan them a van that was for sale. And he grabbed a few of his men, he put them in the van, and he took off driving. And the first question out of the guy's mouth was, "Pastor, where are we going?" And he said, "What do you think about the view? As you can look out these windows all the way around, do you think like that the view?" And they said, "Yeah, Pastor, that's a really nice view," as they're driving down the road. He said, "But where are we going?" And he said, "Did you notice that I can turn the radio on up here and have it at a different volume than you have it back there?" And they said, "Yeah, that's really good, Pastor, but where are we going?" He said, "Did you notice the captain's chairs back there? You could turn those captain's chairs towards each other, and there's a little table, and you actually have a conference meeting going on while we're going down the road." About that time, you know, he'd been driving for a while, and they needed some gas. He said, "Guys, I need a contribution here to help put some gas in this van." And the guys, you know, begrudgingly reached in their pockets and threw a couple of dollars at him, and they got back in the van, and they started driving down the road, and they said again, said, "Pastor, where are we going?" And he kept praising the accolades of the van, and then he ran over something in the highway, and they caused a flat tire. And now they don't know where the donut is. They don't know how to get. So the men are rolling their sleeves up. They're grumbling, and they're sweaty as they get out of the van, and they're changing this tire, and they get back in the van, and the question is still the same. "Pastor, where are we going?" Now, let's change the scenario a little bit. Same van, same group of people. They've gotten a call from Pine Valley, California, where their kids are at youth camp, and a fire has broken out on three sides of the camp and is moving toward the camp, and they're the only side that can get there and rescue them. What do you think the difference is in using the van now? There's purpose. There's knowledge, there's direction. If you run out of gas, they're going to throw their credit cards at you. If you have a flat tire, they're going to jump into action because they know they're on a mission to accomplish the saving of people's lives. There's a difference. I think this is the difference in church. This is the difference in church. A lot of times we look at it and we hear these things and we just wonder, okay, so we need a new parking lot, so we need a new building, so we need more materials. So where are we going with that? What is that actually going to accomplish? But when we see lives being affected and being transformed and changed, then all of a sudden, those things make a lot more sense to us. I believe we have this passage of scripture right here that is a driving force for me for microchurch. This is about microchurch, by the way, if you didn't grasp that from some of the things that Mike has been put out. It says, but Jesus put out another parable for them saying, the kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed that a man took and he sowed in his field. It's the smallest of all seeds, but when it has grown, it is larger than all the garden plants and becomes a tree so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches. Now, I was in agriculture and I was a crops judger, and one of the crops that we looked at was mustard seed. I don't know if you've ever seen one. Probably not, because they're really hard to see. they're literally like a speck of dust in your hand. And he says this of the smallest seeds can go. There's something about the small that is at the heart of Jesus. He talked about little children. And he said, don't let anybody harm one of these little children. He's talking about the least. And I think that one of the things we forget is that Jesus is after the least and the lost. The least and the lost. The lost sheep, the lost coin, the lost son. Remember those parables in chapter 15? He's after the lost. He's after the least. And in our culture, we tend not to even look in the eyes of the lost and in the eyes of the least. When I was sharing with Mike that I visited a micro church basically in Shreveport, Louisiana, a young lady named Cassie Hammett does an organization called Love Well. And she doesn't always know what to say to people that are on the streets, but she always looks them in the eye and acknowledges something about them. Because you can hand money to the person on the corner with the sign, right? And that may not be what he needs. And if you ask him, he might actually say that's not what he wants. What he really wants, yeah, he'll take your dollar, he'll take your food, he'll take an opportunity from you. But what he wants is to be recognized. What he wants is to be acknowledged that he's a human being. What he wants is for his fears and apprehensions about how he lives and where he lives to kind of dissipate some way. So sometimes we approach, and there's a great book, by the way, called When Helping Hurts. I recommend that, because a lot of times we think we're helping when actually we're hurting the situation. So during this time, the church has kind of, the name church, as Mike alluded to, has become kind of an institution. There's the church, I call it the church, the mothership. That would be those that have hierarchies, like the Catholic Church, right? Or the Presbytery or something. They have these hierarchies that kind of hand down rules. And so when people in those churches say church, they're thinking about something more institutional. Where I grew up in Baptist life in Oklahoma, when you say church, you're talking about the building down the street. You know, there's Church Row. There's this church, there's that church. There's every other kind of church kind of all in a row in your little towns there. But when I say church today, and actually church to most of the people that I relate to in this generation, they're actually talking about a community of believers that do life together and live on mission. I got this contrast in my mind when I was going to the Baptist Student Union at one of the universities in Oklahoma, because when we would go, there would be these retreats, and you would see these pictures, and you would see these kids in campgrounds, and there'd be pine trees behind them, and they'd have these signs, they'd be wearing crazy clothes, and they'd be playing kickball or something. But you go today to look at campus ministries, and the pictures are very different. The pictures are students in a village in Africa handing out food. The pictures are students trudging through ankle-deep mud in Ecuador to reach a barrio that's never heard about Jesus before. You see, the students today, when they go on mission, they go on mission. They don't go on retreat to huddle together. They go on mission to accomplish something. I think I have an illustration. I have an illustration that's red and blue there, Mike. So this is a business model, actually, the red ocean and the blue ocean. And it indicates in the red, you know what, when the water turns red, what's going on, right? The sharks are attacking. and there's a lot of blood going on for whatever is living there, right? You know, God, I'm going to just sidebar, God feeds all the animals in the Pacific Ocean every day, and it would cost our national debt to do it. And he does it every day. But then there's this blue ocean. Okay, so the red ocean represents, in America, I'm going to use America first, in America, a shrinking number of about 40% of the people who have an idea that as we speak the Christianese language, they would understand what we're talking about, or they would have an idea, or they might be open to talk about God. They might call themselves spiritual. They might say, oh, I got saved once, or they might use some sort of religious terminology and understand what we're saying. That number is shrinking every day in America. And this is where, I probably can't give you a percentage, but I'm going to say this is where the greatest percentage of churches in America fish is in the red ocean, where people understand their terminology. But then there's 60 to 80% of the people in the blue ocean that don't understand those terms, that don't speak that language, that don't have the concept of God that we have, and we're not fishing there. Somebody wrote a song for me one time at college, and they said, don't go fishing in your own baptismal pool. Have you ever been to one of those churches where the way they boost up their baptism numbers is they keep preaching doubt to their people until they're baptized several times? Yeah, I've been to those churches. They just want to count the numbers. So here's another question I ask pastors. When pastors, you pastors that have been to pastors' fellowships, when a pastor asks another pastor, how's it going? What does he really mean? How many butts do you have in the seat? How many dollars do you have coming in? That's what he means, right? I've yet to go to a pastor's conference fellowship, I may one day, where they ask the pastor, how is God using your church to transform your community? Isn't that the real question? How is God using your church to transform your community? Why do you think your church is in the community that it's in? Probably somebody at some point had a vision that this community needed the gospel of Jesus Christ and needed to be reached, but somehow it's kind of faded away. Then we have Matthew 6, 18. Oh, by the way, if we go back that slide, in the world, this red ocean is much smaller and the blue ocean is much larger worldwide. It's like 10%. And everybody in the world, in Christian life, are trying to fish in that red ocean. Now let's go to the next slide on scripture. This scripture is one that you're really well aware of. This is after Jesus had sent the disciples out. He called them back together. He says, who do men say that I am? Some said, hey, you're John the Baptist. You're one of the prophets. He goes, nope, I still got my head. And he goes, so I'm not one of them. And then Peter says, but who? Now here's the question. Wait, Jesus just sent them out for 2 weeks, right? He comes back and he says, who do you say that I am? Now, wait, whoa, whoa. Me, my Baptist heritage says, time out. Wait, you mean we sent somebody out without training them? We sent somebody out without them knowing all of the Roman road? We sent somebody out without all of this. Jesus sent them out to experience first. And then he brought them back and said, who did they say I am? And now who do you say I am? And when Peter answers, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God, he says, Peter, your name is going to be called Petros, right? The little chip of this rock. And upon this Petra, the statement that I'm the Christ, the Son of the living God, will I build my church. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. We know the implications of that, right? It doesn't take a genius to realize that gates don't attack anybody. But that's the posture that the church has taken. The church has, as large, has taken the posture that the gates that he's talking about are our gates, the gates of our church. The gates that he's talking about are not the gates of the church. You can see it right there. The gates of hell. So Satan, in his casting down to earth and in his freedom that Christ and God has given him, he has established territories that he has possessed for a great many centuries in our world. And he does not give them up easily. And I believe it's the task of believers and churches to attack the gates of hell. This is where microchurch comes in. So you think, how can microchurch, how can something so small, 10, 12, 20 people, have such a big effect? Well, let me ask you, how many of you got COVID? It was a pretty small thing, wasn't it? How long did it take COVID to travel worldwide? It's a few months, right? Just a few months, and it's traveled worldwide, and I'm dealing with people that have had it two or three times, and I've lost people to it, people that I know, and I've seen people survive it greatly. As something as small as COVID can penetrate humanity. By the way, only thing you need to get COVID is to be alive. Right? COVID's not interested in the dead people, right? Think about that in terms of church. Think about that in terms of our culture. This virus that we have, that's Christianity, is sent to us to infect living people. Living people. God is not a God of the dead. Remember me saying that? He's a God of the living. And he wants us to go after those who are living because they have a small period of time. So after we think about the gates of hell, anybody have any questions about that? Do you understand that? So we're to be on the assault in the territory that has belonged to Satan. And I think you can probably think of some of those, and we're going to mention some here in just a moment. I'm going to let these guys tell you about some of them they're entering into. But micro churches have what we call an ecclesial minimum, and I think that's on a circular chart. It has three circles, right? This would be the ecclesial minimum of a micro church: worship, community, and mission, if you went clockwise. Worship, community, and mission. And where all of these circles, where all of them intersect, this is church. This is church. This is disciple-making church. There are a lot of large churches today that met today and are going to meet later today. And people can attend and not be known, not be discipled, or not have fellowship. Correct? Hopefully when you come here each Sunday, you are known, you are heard, and you have fellowship, and hopefully that extends into a mission. Now, some of those circles can be larger and smaller. Like, you know, some people, you know, the community is larger. The community of people is bigger and more intense. To some people, the ecclesia, the ecclesiology of worship, the Christology of who Jesus is bigger. But if you have two of those and you don't have the other one, you're out of balance. You're out of balance in your discipleship making. And one of the things that microchurch focuses on is you can have lots of other stuff, but if you don't have these three things, you don't have church. Does that make sense? If you don't have these three things, you don't have what is the essence of church. So worship, community, and missions. Let me ask you a question. If Jesus were walking physically, walking the streets of Gilbert and Mesa and Chandler today, where do you think he might gravitate toward?
The homeless.
Homeless, okay. Why the homeless?
Downtrodden.
Downtrodden, marginalized, cast out, in despair. Why? Why would Jesus be drawn to them? They can't help him. Okay. And sometimes have you ever heard churches say, this is our prospect list? Do you know where the word prospect came from? Came from mining. Came from discovering something that you could sell and be useful to you. So I think we need to change our terminology of who a person is that's a candidate for Christ, right? I call them pre-believers. They're pre-Christian. They're in his sight and he hasn't quite reached them yet. So I think if Jesus were walking on earth, yeah, he'd look at the homeless. Yes. Who else? Where else would he go? Yeah, I think he'd be in the bars myself. I like to go to the bars. If you see me in a bar, I guarantee you I'll be sitting at the bar and I'll be drinking iced tea, okay? Just so you, some of you went, that's where some of the best conversations happen. That's where people want to meet other people. That's where people want to talk about their lives. That's where people dump the heavy stuff that's been weighing on their minds for a week. Sit at the bar. Listen to some people. You're going to find out. So I think Jesus would be at the bar. In fact, that's what he got accused of, wasn't it? Hanging out with tax collectors and sinners. Jesus' name, one of his pseudo-phrase names, is friend of sinners. Friend of sinners. That's where he's going to be. Do you think we should be where he's going to be? If we followed Jesus, do you think we would end up in some of those places? Yeah, I think so. Throughout time, the church has been small. I don't know if you know that or not. Throughout time, the church has been small. Today, worldwide, the church, worldwide, is less than 30. Just so happens to be that we live in a metropolitan area that per capita has the largest number of mega churches of any city in America. Per capita. But guess what? It's still less than 2% of the people. So there's a big blue ocean out there, and the red ocean's going after just this small segment of people. So if we're not the church in its simplest form, then we cannot be the church. This lunch. Then we cannot be the church in its most complex form. Do you understand what I'm saying? If we can't be the church in its simplest form, how can we be the church in its most complex form? Many people will walk into church today and not get that discipleship making. So I'm going to do a breakdown of our distribution of some of our micro churches. We're at the beginning. Micro Light is at the beginning. I don't want you to think that we're done or that we're finished or that we're polished or that we even know what we're doing. Because we don't. We're walking along this. There are some people that have gone ahead of us, and I'll refer you to one of those guys. I lost the book somewhere. Here it is. His name is Brian Sanders. I lost your music. His name is Brian Sanders, and he wrote a book called Micro Churches. It's really, I like micro church small books, right? Because if it has pictures, I'd do even better. Yeah, I told you I didn't have an education, right? So Micro Churches by Brian Sanders, and the subtitle is A Smaller Way. A Smaller Way. So in America, that, by the way, the average church, I did worldwide, in America, the average church is 60 or less. So it fits, okay, it's not just small. You know, when something starts small, it doesn't mean it can't multiply. So the phases of a micro church would be ideation. What's my idea, and how are we going to think through how to impact our culture? The second phase would be iteration. How are we going to actually start approaching this problem that we see happening in our culture and engage Christ? The third step, which we're not at, by the way, would be codification. We've narrowed in on becoming refined at what we're focused on. Maybe in apartments, maybe we've become somewhat refined in apartments, but not in some other areas. And the last phase would be expansion. Those four phases will take some micro churches 5 years. Those four phases will take some micro churches 5 weeks. It all depends on, and by the way, in the ideation and the iteration phase, they all fail at some point. They all fail. But we ask them to fail forward, to not fail and then not get up and try again just because it didn't work. So I'm going to ask Troy to come. He's going to share some things that he's in. There's a microphone right here. Troy, let me hand it to you. And he's going to share some of the things that are going on in our culture that you might not have been aware of. I can't pull it all the way off, but I'm going to have you come over here. Man. Come on, because we got an online audience that needs to hear you. Okay? All right, there you go.
Morning, everyone. So I was going to try to read this word for word, but I don't think I can. But my name's Troy, and again, I met Pastor Lewis about 25, almost 30 years ago. It's been a great relationship. But some of the things that I am involved in, there's several organizations, but one is the foster care. I work with an organization called Reach Family Services, and they support foster kids who are the age of foster kids, and they support them in different ways, whether that be, you know, financially or, you know, with, you know, things. You know, one of my friends introduced me to the organization, and it was at Thanksgiving time, so I went and volunteered my time and helped them feed the youth. There's about 50, anywhere between 50 and 55 kids in that organization. And then we turned around and did the shoebox, what I call the Christmas Angel program for Christmas. And then I took over the program, basically, and made sure all 55 of those kids got a Christmas gift, you know, the last 4 years. So they support them not only that way, but also counseling type services or like a big brother, big sister, making sure you're just there for them, because most of them just want to know you care. And then another organization, well, before I go to that, approximately in Arizona, approximately 14,000, there's about 14,000 kids in the foster system right now, and only about 4,500 licensed foster families. So there's a very big lacking in there. Excuse me. And then one of the other organizations is actually working with aged out foster kids. And one of the organizations that I work closely with is called Foster 360. And the original founder of that company, she has a lot of education and training in trauma. And every one of the kids, she has an actual facility where she houses the kids. It's finally full after several years, but she has a lot of training, and she has taken every one of her kids that's in her homes off the street and out of major trauma, and she's in the process of training them. And I think, if I'm not mistaken right now, every one of them are back into society and have jobs.
They all have jobs.
And so that's huge. And with the aged out foster, so what a lot of people don't know, and what I didn't know about aged out foster kids, is when they turn 18, their benefits stop. So in Arizona, 40% of those kids end up homeless by 19. 49% have at least one kid by 21. 73% of them graduate high school, as opposed to 90% of the regular population, and only 3% of them go and get a college degree. Okay? 25% end up in the justice system, and in the homeless community, 50% of the homeless have been in the foster system. Okay? So that's one, and there's another organization called Help Me Help You. I haven't introduced you guys yet. And then I don't know if this is going to get touched down, but one of the other, I have an acquaintance that I introduced them to, and in the homeless community, we're looking at providing them, having them be able to take a shower. So there's going to be some mobile showers that we're going to be helping them with, and laundry services so that they can get clean clothes and clean up. So those are the few organizations that I'm. Is that it?
Yeah. Do you have a question for him about any of
that? Any questions about any of that?
How do you think God led you into this? You kind of started where you are, but how did God work in your life to put you in?
Well, I have six kids myself. So I love kids, and I love helping kids. And when my son went into junior high, I actually, you know, I'm one of those dads, or me and my ex-wife were one of those families where all the kids just came over our house. It was one of those things. And I actually went into the junior high and became a teacher assistant. And while I was there, I actually started mentoring kids. I started seeing that a lot of these kids don't have fundamentals. They're not taught fundamentals. They don't have people who care. So I just started caring for them. And one story, if I can tell this, that I kind of like to share, and I kind of like to think I had a little bit of impact in this life. So I had a young lady who I met her in seventh grade, when she was in seventh grade, and it was a reading class, and she would always come to me, "Mr. G, I can't do this. Mr. G, I can't do this." And I finally said, "Kat, stop telling me you can't do this. Go over there and just get it done. If you have any questions, come see me." Well, she was kind of voluntold, so to say. She didn't start a gang, but she had leadership skills, so they just kind of made her the leader of this gang, right? They never went out to start stuff, but she, you know, they never backed down. So CD student, leader of this gang. Now eighth grade year, I see her sitting in the front of class, starting to get better grades, and is no longer running with these people. Forward to her ninth grade year, she's on the cheerleading squad, straight A student, leading to her senior year, graduating a semester early and going into a physical therapy program. And I just kind of think that because I cared and I told her she could do it, and she started believing it, and that's kind of where it took off from there. So I have a vision for a nonprofit myself to do some things in that nature, but that's what led me into these other kids, and just knowing that I think I have a gift talking to that age and the junior high and high school. So I've just kind of ran with it. And then he came to me with the micro church idea, and it just blended in together. So.
Thank you. And we probably have some of that from our institutions, even in our Southern Baptist network. They have to draw a strict line, right? But they, when they receive government money, but what we're talking about, these entities we're talking about don't receive government money. They raise their own. They raise their own funds to do that.
Now, one thing that I do want to say, there are people in the foster system, but there are some people who are not good. They're in it for the money. And there needs to be better people in the foster system. And not just like foster families, but there's homes that mm-hmm. house these foster kids, or group homes, and they're just in it for the money. So I know the person who I introduced them to, I think is going to be one of the people who helped change that. But there needs to be more people that care.
So one of the ideas here, Tim, you're next. One of the ideas here is that if every church in America, I'm just going to say our state, I can do that. If every church in our state had one foster family, it would occupy every foster need in our state.
Y'all if are every, taking all my notes.
Tim was a, come on, Sarah. This is Tim and Sarah Jennings, and they're going to tell their story about their foster children who are now.
I'll just say hi.
Okay. So we started, obviously we have adopted. These are our children. Harmony will be 9 next week. Artesia will be 8 in January. So we'd had no desire to foster. We had absolutely zero desire to foster. We wanted to adopt. And in the state of Arizona, to get your, basically to be licensed for adoption, it's the same license as foster care. And so, because the big thing you hear about adoption is it's so expensive. But what people don't realize is if you adopt through your state, it's free. And so if you adopt through the foster care system, there are thousands of kids who have already had their rights severed who are just looking for a home at this point. And so that's what we wanted to do. In order to do that, you had to get the same license for foster care as you would adoption. And so we were told you could do that, but you just, when it comes time for placement, you just tell them, you know what, I don't want to foster. And you know, I'm just here to adopt. And that was our goal. That was our plan. That was the only thing that we had desired to do. Because we thought just the same thing that we heard all the time is, oh, I don't know how you could ever foster and then have to give them away or give them back or something like that. And we were sitting there in our first class. We were sitting there just listening to them talk. And immediately we're hearing about, at that time, 19,000 kids in Arizona in foster care. And we're just sitting here hearing story after story, and I'm going, okay, God, I'm cool with fostering, but you're going to have to change my wife. Like, I can't do this without her and her support. And long story short, we got in the truck to leave that night, and she looked at me and she said, we have to do something. And I said, okay, I'm so glad you said that, because I definitely want to too. And so we did. We became foster parents. It's tough. It's not easy. The state makes things some difficult. There's lack of resources, lack of training, lack of a lot of stuff. But again, if nobody's going to do it, then these kids now, 14 to 17,000, nobody's going to be there for them. And so I would say the biggest thing that I've learned is when someone always says how I couldn't do it, I couldn't raise a kid and have the possibility of me having to give them back. And what we always tell people is if we're adults, we're grown-ups. We can sift and wade through our own emotions and our own feelings. These are kids who can't. Mm-hmm. And if I can wade through the hurt in my own heart so a kid knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that they felt loved, I would do it every day of the week ending in Y. And so you don't have to be a foster parent. No, it's not for everybody. But like Lewis said, if every church in North America would just foster or adopt one kid, there would be no orphans in our country. And James 1:27 tells us that pure and undefiled religion is to take care of the orphans and the widows in their need. So that tells me that the church in North America is not doing its job. Again, you don't have to be a foster parent. There are things that you can do to help foster parents. Foster parents are in desperate, desperate needs of date nights. You could babysit for 4 hours and you would change the life of a foster parent. There are organizations like Arizona Baptist Children's Services. That's who we adopted through. They also have a Christmas tree, angel tree options, things like that. There is hundreds of ways that you could impact the foster care system. And I would just encourage you to seek that out, to find that or anything like that. That's what we do. That's why we're here. That's our micro church kind of deal. Mm-hmm. And so it's exciting to also get to work with Troy. In fact, I've got a truckload of supplies from Superstition Foothills Baptist Church for Foster 360. So it gives us an opportunity to serve one another.
Thanks, Tim.
Yep.
We don't want to bore you with that, but I do want to share something with you, Lee. This is fantastic. I want you guys to have any questions. You have conversations with these guys afterwards. This is something about microchurch and Lighthouse Network. I texted him when you were up here with your Christmas box, and they agreed in our organization to pay for all of your shipping.
Yes.
Okay. So that's what I like about the ability of microchurch to be able to pivot and answer a need that happens immediately. Lou's going to come and talk about apartments.
Good morning. My name's Lou DeBona. I drive a cab, and I've got to run it to pick up at 15 minutes. So we talk about apartment communities. We know that the big thing it used to be apartment complexes. If you notice, they've changed how they operate. They're now called communities or homes. They don't call them complexes anymore. We know going in that the biggest thing for apartment communities is retention. They want to keep the people at the apartment complex because that's how the owners make their money. They don't want to see turnover. They're big on being above 90% full. So they try to do whatever they can to keep people in the apartment community. Well, we all have an agenda. We want to see people come to know the Lord. My job is not to get you baptized. My job is to introduce you to Jesus. That's my job. That's how I read scripture. So when we go into an apartment community, we don't have to talk about religion. Religion. We go in and say, we know up front that you want to do some things to keep people. So we go in and we meet the managers that are running the community. And we say, we know that we have resources that we come in and do activities. You name it, we've done it all. Shoe drives, Christmas programs. They lived in an apartment community. I moved into Sienna Vista Mobile Home Park, and I had to move in after my wife started traveling because she wouldn't want to move in. So I moved in after, and when she came home, she had to move in with me. So I got around that one. But I lived there for 7 years.
Sports camps.
Backpacks. You name it, we've done it.
Ice cream social.
We just did one this week at Avila Apartment Community. We're just giving out ice cream. That's all we're doing. We're not talking about anything. They drive the people that come in drive the conversation. They drive the conversation. We don't say anything. Here's an ice cream. A gentleman walked in. His name is
Jonathan.
There was another gentleman, I forget.
The Army guy?
No, the guy that.
Oh, that was with us, Ed Brin.
He has a PTSD. He has a traumatic brain injury. I also served in the Army 10.5 years. 5 years Air Force Reserve. But he comes in, he just starts talking. We hand him an ice cream, he just opens up. Jim was able to talk to him because he's a chef. He had his own business. So they hit it off, they started talking. But this kid is 31, Jewish. Medically, he shouldn't be standing there, from what he told us. Medically, he shouldn't be standing there. And he's very intelligent, but we sat for almost an hour talking to this gentleman about his condition, what his belief is. I mean, and Lewis said, look, we'd just like to pray for you for 2 weeks and see what happens. That's all. We'll pray for you 2 weeks, and then we'll go back, and we'll try to visit. We'll But that's what we do. We go in and just bring activities. We cook breakfast. We do cookouts. I'm going to tell you a couple stories. When we were at Garden Place, I asked the Lord to reach the youth. And I'm thinking high school. He brings in first through fifth grade. I'm going, okay. The first night we meet on a Wednesday night, there's a fourth grade girl that asks her first question, how long are you going to be here? The reason she asked that question, because of the men and females that are in and out of her life. She wanted to know how long we were going to stay. The second thing I asked was, I wanted to take them to camp. And I thought, okay, Lord, it's going to take us a year to get to travel, the kids to go, to sign up for camp. It was done in 1 week. The Lord did it in 1 week. And I went with them. There were five boys that I was counselor to. Now, we talk about micro church, and we talk about what we can do as individuals. You can do all of this. If the Lord lays it on your heart, you do it. We'll make sure it gets done. It can be done. So we go to camp. The five boys I had, first through sixth grade, we have a rest period during camp, Monday through Friday. We rest in the afternoon. The first conversation the boys were talking about was, these are first through fifth grade. Their conversation during the first rest period was, what does your boyfriend's mom do? Does he beat her? Does he beat you? Does he destroy furniture? That was their conversation. These boys are supposed to be talking about sports, cooties, not being around girls. But that was a conversation the first night, first afternoon. By Friday, I couldn't get them off me. I couldn't get them off me. That was a change in 5 days. I want to talk one more story, and this involves foster care. I drive a cab. We had a contract with DCS, Department of Child Services, and we talk about what one individual can do. I was transporting a young lady who was 17 years old going to, I forget the name of the high school, Skyline. I was transporting her because we had a contract for DCS to transport her to school and to work. She was getting ready to graduate high school. She turned 18, which means everything stops. Our transportation stops. Everything stops. She gets no services whatsoever. I said to her, because I built a relationship with her, taking her every day, I said, look, I'll take you to school. I'll take you to work so that you can continue what you do, because she has no support. She's living with guardians who we're not helping. We're making it more difficult. And they're supposed to be her guardians. I found out that she had a father and three siblings in Mississippi. And she wanted to bring them back here. Now, this girl was advocating for herself. And she's 17 years old. She found a family that would take her siblings here in Arizona. Because she knew if they went into the system in Mississippi, it's worse than the one in Arizona. So I said, you know what? Let's go. I'll go to Mississippi with you. We'll bring him back. So I went with her in Mississippi, brought him back. She goes to NAU, and I've adopted her as my another grandchild. But I want to talk about what you think individually we can't do anything. Yes, we can. What the Lord lays on your heart. Microchurch is about what the Lord lays on your heart to do, you go and do. I've known Lewis for...
Don't go there.
A long time. I came to know the Lord at 39 because of my daughter, not because of church, because of my daughter. So you can do something. That's the key. Do something.
Thanks, Lou. Thank you, Lou.
And now your eminence, Byron Banta, is going to share briefly. He didn't wear his ring, so we don't have to kiss it.
Shut up, Lewis. I'm here standing in for a father and a daughter who are involved in MicroLite. One of the big problems in the culture today is people with unwanted pregnancies. And so many times, as you know, they end in abortion. Well, Arizona Southern Baptist, through Arizona Baptist Children's Services, have scattered across the state some new life pregnancy centers that help people just in that condition. They'll do pregnancy tests. They do counseling. They do classes. They furnish supplies for babies. They share the gospel with people at every opportunity and help people to decide to keep their babies. And some who are already planning to keep their babies are poor. They don't have a family. They don't have a husband. And so they need supplies. They need just baby supplies and counseling and encouragement. And there's a couple in our fellowship who are really interested in doing that. And they have gotten involved and an increasing involvement with the New Life Pregnancy Center at City Point Church, which is roughly southern and rural. And they're getting involved and taking them supplies. And I don't know how much, but I know it's really generous to help this pregnancy center to minister to these young women. And there is an aspiration that the daughter is going to be able to actually go there and physically serve on site as a volunteer. This is something that all of us could get involved in. And one of the things that microchurch does that I really like is that you just don't throw money at something. Because in City Point Church, which we host that, it meets on our campus, and we want to expand it. Lewis and I were talking about that driving over here. I'm anxious to see what City Point's goal is and how they want to assist in that. But it's such an important thing that we do, and I'm really glad to be a part of a church that's involved in that, and I'm glad God has put that on the hearts of some of our people.
Thank you, Byron. Thank you. So we're probably past time. And
we have no such thing.
Yeah, no, it's no such thing. I did want Mike to pull up our website. It's microlight.church if you want to find it. And on one of the pages, on the front page, I think it's under our story. Yeah, look at that. I don't know how to use a Mac, so thank you. Under who we are, and then our story, right below, right there. Notice I was at a light festival in Queen Creek and took that. Notice that God didn't put all the stars in one corner of the sky? Because it doesn't dispel darkness that way. And he doesn't put all of the Christians in one corner of the world either, or in one corner of the community. He spreads them out. And then if you'll scroll down, all the way down, right there. So these are some of the crevices that we've identified in our culture. I'm going to leave with Mike a hub community assessment form that I received from the lady in Shreveport about how to actually assess your community and determine where it is and what it is that God wants you to do and what other people are doing. We're not here to replicate stuff necessarily. Sometimes somebody's doing it well, we just want to support it. But we do want to see the people face to face. If Cassie told me that she had Joe down on the corner and he didn't have any shoes, and I said, let me buy Joe some shoes. You know what Cassie would say to me? That's great. You buy Joe some shoes and then go with me to give them to him. Because we want to make the connection face to face. We want to actually meet the people, see their eyes, understand their heart, know what's going on. It's like going to Foster 360. Byron and I will never forget meeting Preston the first day. And by the way, Preston needs an engine for his car. And so Tim or Luke, Tim, if you can get with Troy, and when you're exchanging goods, could you go to Fry's and buy 2-month-long bus passes?
Yeah, I'll get it.
Okay, so that he can take them with him because they have 2 kids that need bus passes. Okay. But unmanned, let me just, since we've been talking about Foster, you can read these, you can find these. Foster is something, you know, we can't solve homelessness. We can't solve poverty. I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime, right? Jesus said, the poor you will have with you always. But I think Foster is something that we can approach. And when you think about what Foster affects, well, I was talking to a corrections officer, it was Roger Prince, And Roger told me 60% of the guys he dealt with in the sexual offending portion of the prison in Florence had come through the foster system. Not only did they not have fathers, but they'd come through the foster system. Homelessness, there are 900 kids that age out of the foster system every year here in the Valley, and half of them end on the streets, which adds to drug addiction, prostitution, human trafficking, homelessness. So if we can deal with fostering kids, helping kids that are aging out of the foster system, I think we can help resolve many of the crevices that already exist in our culture. That's why we emphasize it so much today with you. By the way, solo familia, single parents, assisting single parents. Sometimes we think that it's only single moms. It's not only single moms. Singletons is not only single moms with cancer. That used to be singleton moms. They changed it because there are single dads that have cancer. And it's dealing with people who have stage 4 or above. They need help getting back and forth, transportation to their treatment. They need help cleaning their house. They need help finding gifts and stuff for Christmas for their children. And some of their children are really young, as these parents have cancer early on. I added Cricket and Curry because there's a huge, I don't know if you've been to the theaters in the North Valley anytime recently, but you can go to the theater in the North Valley, Harkins or AMC, and on a given good push-off weekend, 3 of the movies will be Bollywood movies. You will have to watch them in subtitles because they're in East Indian, because there are so many East Indians in our country. There are 6 cricket leagues in the Valley, full-blown cricket leagues for the East Indian men to play cricket. And this is a population we haven't even begun to touch with the gospel, really, at all. And they're very open to you talking. By the way, they will include Jesus in their gods, but they won't make Jesus exclusive. So it's important that we have to work through that. But please take a look at the website, look at some of these crevices, and we're just discovering some of them. We're on the cusp of getting there. Okay? Any questions about any of that? I have one thought I want you to think about. It's the other slide with some words on it. And I want you just to think about this for a minute. I want you to meditate on it, and then we're going to pray. It's the one with a lot of words, I think. Like the third one down there. Yeah, right here. I want you just to read this and think about it for a second. Let's pray for just a second. God, you are not tame in any way, but you are good. Help us be as creative in the way that you've engineered us as you chose us to be. Help us not to settle for status quo. Drive us with the things that drive you. Move us to the people that you see. Help us find those that need a physician. And help us bring unbelievers along with us who have ideas about these same social